This is Rabbi Jeff Sachs of Atid and Web Yeshiva with another installment in our Modern Jewish History series from webyeshiva.org. Okay, good evening. Welcome back, or welcome to those of you that are new. We are continuing with our study of Jewish history. If you were with us last semester, we're continuing, although you won't be left in the dark. Just by a quick show of hands, raise your hand if you were not in the class for most of last semester. Okay. Is that Ben or is it Barbara that's with us, or both? Barbara, okay, and I see we have okay, Alan and Barbara. So these we all know one another. I suppose that we're mostly familiar, having bumped into each other at other Web Yeshiva classes. I didn't send my video. If you have your video on, please hit the send video button, and we'll start in just a moment. Okay, here we're all joining in from all over the place, from Hawaii to Chicago to Harnof. How often do people from Hawaii and Harnof learn together? That's the wonders of Web Yeshiva. Not often. Okay, last semester, and if you're interested, MP3 record, if you were registered for the course, then you can go into our archives and get the full archive of each course. If you were not registered for last semester's course, you can visit our friends, I'll say our associates, at yutorah.org. It's a very good website. I'll put the link up right there. yutorah.org. And the MP3s, just the MP3s, the sound recording of the introductory session of these Jewish history courses can be found there, and that might give you some interesting background to some of the things that we're talking about. That semester, the introduction to modern Jewish history, which we're continuing with this semester, I started off by showing this iconic image, the yellow star, the yellow patch. I trust that you all catch this very stark visual reference, and I posited, although it's somewhat anachronistic, I posited that the story of modern Jewish history can be viewed through the lens of these two stars, of the yellow patch and of the Kechol Velavan, the blue and white Magen David of the Degel Yisrael. I talked about this a little bit on the session that we had on Yom Ha'atzmut, or in advance of Yom Ha'atzmut, I guess the week before last. I don't remember, nor was it last. No, last week. And you can listen to that recording, for more on this. But the dialectic of modern Jewish history between both of these images represent answers to the same question, to what was famously called the Jewish question. Here we are. We're living in Europe is the focus of much of what we're talking about, but it's true elsewhere in the world as well. We're living here in Europe, and amongst us, majority Christians or majority Muslims even, we have these Jews, and they're not exactly like us. they're not Englishmen, and they're not Frenchmen, and they're not Spaniards, and they're not Germans, and they're not part of the motherland or the fatherland. They're here. They're useful. They're friendly. They're nice. They're courteous. They're kind. They're alternatively viewed as vile, disgusting usurers. They're viewed as agents of the devil. They're viewed as criminal. They're viewed as any type of thing from good to bad, but they're not one of us. They're not part of us. Not only because we worship different gods and we have different conceptions of the Messiah and whether or not he has already come and whether or not he is yet to come again, but because they are just the embodiment. Again, I'm taking on the voice of Christian culture. I'm not expressing my own opinion, speaking in the first person here. But the Jews, they're other. They're wholly different than us. They're demonic because of that. And this question, the Jewish question of, well, what are we going to do with them? How are we going to find a place for them in this society of ours, is answered in an array of different manners. The most famous, infamous, really, the most infamous answer to the Jewish question was, of course, that of the Nazis. Well, they don't belong here, and therefore we should exterminate them. And that will be, again, speaking in the voice of the Nazis, that will be a very, very effective answer to the Jewish question. We don't want them. They don't belong here. Let's exterminate them, like we do when we have cockroaches in the house. It's a very effective solution to the question. It's so effective that we can even term it the final solution, because after we've implemented the solution, the question will have been resolved. But, of course, it wasn't the final solution. It was the attempt at what became the penultimate solution. The real solution comes in the image of the second star, the image of the idea of the return of Jewish sovereignty. The Jews don't belong there, but they do belong in a place where they can control their own affairs. And Zionism, the idea of Jewish return principally to Eretz Yisrael, to the land of Israel, but broader political Zionism and the idea that the Jews' problem is that we are under the thumb of a foreign nation or foreign leaders, and we need to be in control of our own affairs, wherever that may be. We need to have our own autonomy. It is in fact the ultimate solution to the question. Esther, I see you have your hand raised. Is that from before, or did you want to say something?
No.
So this is the tale of Jewish history, and we talked about how it played itself out in the pre-modern period, in the early modern period. We talked about a number of different phenomena in the larger society, internal Jewish culture and life. We talked about Hasidut, we talked about the Yeshivot, we talked about the Gzerot Tach V'Tat, the terrible pogroms of 1648 and 1649, which like the fall of the first in a row of dominoes, set off in a long line of events that had many and very far-reaching consequences for Jewish life in Europe and elsewhere. And we started then talking about the Enlightenment, these radical changes that start sweeping Europe, the way people view themselves, the way they view society, the way they view their relationship to one another and to the government, and what the very role of the government is, and what the very what the nature of leadership is, where authority is drawn from. These Enlightenment ideas that sweep Europe during the 18th century, and not just Europe, North America, the United States. The founding of the United States is very much an extension of this. Have very serious consequences for Jewish life as well. We talked about the Haskalah as a type of internal Jewish enlightenment. But then we started talking about the larger political questions of what this means for Jewish life in Europe, particularly as it plays out in the question of emancipation. This until now, this has all been by way of review of some of the topics we touched on in the last semester. The idea of emancipation, not that the Jews were literally slaves, but the idea of, like we talk about in America, the Emancipation Proclamation, let's say, but the idea of affording the Jewish minority in any host nation full citizenship with all of the rights thereunto pertaining, this is the question that has to be answered by the emancipation, so that in 1789, the Declaration, let me just make this a little more visible. 1789, of course, you remember Louis. Well, let's go back. This will just be really by way of review. There he is. There he is, Louis XVI. Louis XVI was the king of France in 1789. And then I'm shortening the story, of course, but along comes Napoleon Bonaparte, whose revolution was, swept not only France but all of Europe. The Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen, that foundational text of the French Revolution. Think of our own. I'm not sure that everybody with us is American. Is there anybody with us that's not American by origin? No, I don't say. Well, Joel's with us. Esther, you lived in Pittsburgh. Okay, Beseder, so by origin we all come from Yerushalayim, but it's true, you were born in England, but you spent many years in America. But besides Joel, we all have the American connection one way or another. So think of our own Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of Independence, this foundational Enlightenment document. So one of the clauses in the Declaration of the Rights of one of the articles in the Declaration of Rights of Man is that no one shall be disquieted on account of his opinions, freedom of opinion, including his religious views, provided their manifestation does not disturb the public order established by law. What's the point of this sentence? There's two angles to it. What's the role of freedom of religion here? So did the Puritans. So did many other groups. Yeah. Right, but correct. But here in the Declaration of the Rights of Man, in the French document, so Sherry points out, as long as you keep your religion private, there's a type of separation of church and state. That notion of separation of church and state is that's the American nusach, that's the American formulation of it. I'm not certain here that there's a separation of church and state as much as a notion that there's tolerance. That no one will be disturbed for their opinions or for their religious views. There's a pluralism at work here. We can have a nation which is not constituted by the idea that we all are common religionists, that we're all Christians of a certain stripe, which was the notion of how of what bound a people together. And now we can be bound together because we are Frenchmen. We are brother Frenchmen. Liberté, égalité, fraternité, brotherhood. But it's the brotherhood of being French, not of being Christian per se. And non-Christians, any other citizen is welcome to be part of this, even if they're not of the same religion, as long as their religion doesn't in any way interfere with their role as a citizen, as long as the religion they practice doesn't prevent them from being a good Frenchman as well. Let me just look at some of these things that are popping up in the quotes. Okay, Tehillé, I assume you're making a joke there. So correct. All of these ideas have to be clarified. It's a declaration. It's not a constitution. It's like the Declaration of Independence as opposed to our own constitution. We have to define what does it mean, public order, and what would a disturbance of public order look like, etc. That's for life and the courts and the legislators to determine. But the principles are what's being laid down here. So after the Declaration of the Rights of Men, the question of what to do with the Jews becomes a sticky one. We have to figure out how can we incorporate the Jews into our life as citizens of the Republic, and yet enable them to be full citizens. How can we enable them to be full citizens, as long as they're not really completely part of us? So there were two, I think I mentioned this again in the last time, there were two centers of Jewish life in the Bayonne, and not New Jersey, but the Bayonne and the Bordeaux region in the southwest of France. There were Sephardic Jews. And in January of 1790, they were granted full citizenship. This was a largely assimilated Jewish community, culturally assimilated. And they were already very integrated into French life. They already were fluent French speakers. They were largely descendants of Marranos, of hidden Jews centuries earlier from the Spanish Inquisition, who had returned to Judaism. And they were also, there was an economic component, that they were very, very influential in the Atlantic sea trade. You see where they are situated. They were merchants, they were shippers, they were importers, exporters. They were very influential in the transatlantic trade industry. So there was an impetus to incorporate them. But for over a year, there was a question of what to do with the Jews of Alsace. These regions up here in northeast France, on the border with today, the border with Germany. There at different points in time, this community is part of France. Sometimes it's part of Germany. It's one of these border areas where it's always slippery. You wake up one morning, you're in a different country. The Ashkenazi community, there were about 35,000 non-acculturated Jews, and they're engaged in small-time trade. They're competitors with the French peasants. They're of course moneylenders, which, I mean, you've seen enough Shakespeare or television to know that this becomes the stereotype of the obnoxious Jew. But yet there's the question of to what degree does the manifestation of their opinions disturb or not disturb the public order. And this becomes a point of debate. If the Jews are really a kind of state within the state, they can't become brothers. They can't become citizens. And the revolution can't tolerate that type of cultural pluralism. So with emancipation, we have to have Frenchification. If we're going to make them citizens, it's on the condition that they agree to acculturate themselves. And the first wave, simply French teachers are sent there to teach them to speak the language. When Napoleon comes to power in 1799, wherever he conquered, whatever territory he conquers, and over the next 10, 12, 13 years, he conquers most of Europe, all the way up to Russia, right? 1812, he's trying to wage his invasion of Russia, right? The 1812 overture, you know, which we some in America, it's often played as patriotic music, and people often think that it is connected to the War of 1812 between America and Britain. It's not. It has nothing to do with that. It's the overture of the French invasion and defeat and turn back in Russia. If you listen to it, you can hear the French and Russian melodies playing out, battling out between them. You know, ba da 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 dum bum ba da 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 dum bum bum. The 1812 overture. Is my singing that funny, Esther? Okay. So wherever Napoleon goes, he establishes the conquered territories as republics, and he extends French law and French citizen to Jews wherever he goes. But there's always the question of well, there's always the question of what about the Jews at home? What about the Jews at home? In 1803, he receives complaints. In 1803, yeah, correct, Tilo. That's the point. That's the point I'm making. You hear the Marseille, you know, in the, you know, as part of the melody, and then you also hear the Russian. There are complaints about Jews at home, about money lending and etc. So what happens is that the government then steps in and starts to regulate interest rates. In other words, the role of the government is to not to oppress, but to create a framework in which Frenchmen can be integrated into the larger society. And there are a number of different examples. I'll skip ahead a little bit. In 1806, Napoleon stages the Assembly of Jewish Notables. We sometimes talk about Napoleon's Sanhedrin. That's this picture here. Here, we talk about the Sanhedrin, quote unquote, the great Sanhedrin that he gathered, and we also talk about the Assembly of Jewish Notables. These were technically two different events, two different gatherings, and sometimes it's confusing because we talk about them in the same breath. They were connected events. This group of notables, of Jewish communal leaders, received 12 very loaded questions about Jewish practice and Jewish ritual and Jewish belief, asking them to respond to these questions in order to see if Judaism interferes with the Jews' ability to be integrated as full citizens. There were both Sfaradim and Ashkenazim from both of the communities who were represented on the committee. Somebody by the name of Avraham Furtado, who was a Portuguese Jew living in France, meaning he was a descendant of the Portuguese Jews. He's the technically the head of the assembly. He's a quite assimilated Jew. In answer to Linda, to your question, he was a very assimilated Jew. They were both religious Jews and assimilated Jews. He's chosen as the head of the assembly, perhaps for PR reasons or for practical reasons. But somebody by the name of Rav David Sintzheim, Sintzheim, who was an Ashkenazi, he's the de facto head, and he's the one that actually drafts most of the answers. They're asked to make determinations or to give explanations of certain halachic practices, but adjust the halacha, adjust Jewish law and ritual to make Judaism not merely palatable. Not palatable to French life, but Frenchifiable. In fact, what happens is that they end up giving a spin on things on the hashkafic or the philosophical or the ideological plane in order to retain the halacha and to show that there really is no conflict. This document that you have here, which, by the way, particularly for any of you that are new, all of these documents and sometimes some more are available on the website of our Shear page. I usually upload them a number of days in advance. You're always welcome to go and download them and to look at these primary texts that we look at. Let's just look at some of these responses of the assembly. Just to look at the questions themselves is interesting. Before we do that, let me just catch a breath. If anybody has any questions, you feel free to ask them. I just want to look over to see who's with us. I see Linda Hannaford. Is that you? Have your mic is on. Do you have a microphone, Linda? No, I guess not. Who are you and where are you from? Where are you joining us from? Borough Park. Huh. Wonderful. And Roxanne, if I remember, you're in Switzerland. Correct. Okay, everybody else are known quantities. So this is the text. This is the primary documents. I mentioned, I don't have the book here to hold you up to the screen. I mentioned that most of these primary texts that we're using comes from a book called The Jew in the Modern World, edited by Mendes Flohr and Reinhardt. It's an anthology of primary documents in modern Jewish history. It's a worthwhile book to have. Alan, if you're still up and able to do that, post the link to that book to Amazon in the chat so everybody can see it. It's worthwhile to see it. It happens that most of those sources that are in that book are also freely available online. I think that in this case, instead of scanning it, I just found it and cut and pasted it from an online site. But that book, of course, has some very important introductions and annotations and footnotes and things like that. And if you were only to buy one book, for your own supplementary reading for the course, that certainly would be a good investment. In the picture on the whiteboard, is the center square? Chaim, I'm not sure I understand your question. If you're having a technical problem, I'm sure Ezra can help you. Hold on, let me. The title of the book is The Jew in the Modern World. Alan must be asleep at the wheel. I'll link it up here. Here's the... Oh, there, Alan, you came to the rescue. There you go. There's the link to Amazon to buy the book. It's a little pricey. It's a little pricey. I'm not sure why that should be. But it's a worthwhile book to have. Okay. This is the document. This is the response that the assembly sends back to Napoleon. Resolved by the French deputies professing the religion of Moses. You see already, we've mentioned this in our discussion of the Haskalah of the Jewish Enlightenment. They don't identify themselves as French Jews. This whole question, I remember in high school, these kinds of sophomoric discussions, you know, which are a few stages above, you know, could Mickey Mouse, could Mighty Mouse beat up Superman or vice versa? Are you a Jewish American or an American Jew? As if summarizing it in one pithy slogan or another, like could sum up your whole identity, when really it's more complicated than that. This question of how do you identify yourself? Are you a French Jew? Are you a Jewish Frenchman? So you're a French deputy professing the religion of Moses. We even leave, you know, the Shoresh Jew or Judaism out of it. You become a professor of the religion of Moses. Roxanne mentions the book The Pity of It All, not by Amos Oz, but by Amos Elon. By Amos Elon, which is also a good book. I mentioned that in the last semester a number of times. That's also a wonderful book. So resolved by the French deputies professing the religion of Moses that the following declaration shall precede the answers returned to the Majesty to return to the questions proposed by the commissioners of His Imperial and Royal Majesty. The Assembly, impressed with a deep sense of gratitude, love, and respect and admiration for the sacred person of His Imperial and Royal Majesty, that's Napoleon. Napoleon was the cat's meow. The Jews all loved Napoleon. In certain Jewish chronicles, his name is rendered. Any French speak, Esther, you must speak French if you spent all those years in England. His name is rendered as Chelik Tov. Why? What does Bonaparte mean? Bonaparte literally means bon, good, part, right? It literally means not partially good, not partially good. He's a chelek tov, right? So that's, you know, that's the part of the admiration for Napoleon. Of course, Napoleon is not a simple character in European history. His Majesty intends for them, the Jews, professing the religion of Moses, who want to prove themselves worthy of the favors of His Majesty, intends for them, by scrupulously conforming to his paternal intentions, that their religion make it their duty to consider the law of the prince as the supreme law in civil and political matters. So this is a notion that we have that already in the Gemara, 1,200 years earlier, had established this notion of Dina de Malchuta Dina, that the law of the land is the law, that Jews are bound by the civil law of whichever society they're living in. Now, this should be obvious, but it should also be obvious. It should also be obvious the idea of Dina de Malchuta Dina it has its limits. Dina de Malchuta Dina doesn't mean that anything that's permitted in a civil society is therefore permitted by the Torah, and neither does it even mean that anything commanded in a civil society necessarily ipso facto becomes permitted by the Torah or mandated by the Torah. It means that, generally speaking, in a just society, we have to fulfill our civic obligations. Paying taxes, for example, is of course always the classic example of this. Consequently, should their religious code, the Jewish religious code, or its various interpretations, contain civil or political commands at variance with those of the French code, those commands would, of course, cease to influence and govern them. Now, this is quite far-reaching and is a pretty radical reinterpretation of the notion of Dina de Malchuta Dina. We'll see as we go on that in reality, they don't go that far. It's more of a rhetorical device, something of a bluff, but it's more of a rhetorical device to say that we are first Frenchmen, and there's nothing in the Shulchan Aruch, there's nothing in the Torah that would prevent us from being a fully integrated citizen. Roxanne points out that there's this issue in Switzerland about Shechita. Linda points out also, and this was also true in different points in history in America, there were different points about this, that that if Shechita, if ritual slaughter, were to be forbidden for whatever reason, and kosher meat would not be available, so then we'd have to, I guess, give up eating meat. But it wouldn't mean that it would be permitted to eat non-kosher meat. In consequence of this principle, the Jews have at times considered it their duty to obey the laws of the state, and that since the revolution, they, like all Frenchmen, have acknowledged no others. That the French government under which we're living. So now, if you look at these questions, first of all, it's quite shocking to read these questions, and it's worth it just to skim through the questions themselves. Maybe we'll just do that now. Part of the questions are an attempt to give an opening to the assembly to make a statement on Jewish policy, but it's also necessary to state these things. Like this first question: is it lawful for Jews to marry more than one wife? Is polygamy permitted according to Jewish law? This is a shocking question. That there were people that were so it's true that we've all heard stories about that one person that was traveling someplace in Mississippi and he encountered the person who thought that Jews actually do have horns under their beanies. But in reality, most modern people in any modern society know what Judaism is. I mean, they don't know every detail about Jewish life and ritual, but they know what a Jew is, and they know, they have a sense of what's what. But this idea that you have to ask a question, hey, do Jews have more than one spouse? This is an indicator of how isolated Jews were. And it's an indicator of the fact that general society really did not know and interact with Jews and Judaism. So this question, for example, is a test case. The idea that you might have polygamy, that you might have more than one wife, is something that's anathema to the French sensibility, as it is to most of our own modern sensibilities, even though we're all aware, of course, Yeah, of course. Chaim asks, did general society have an access to translation of Chumash? Of course, they had the what they call the Old Testament. Of course they did. And then they read it quite regularly. Which may be where they get this notion that, you know, perhaps Jews still have more than one spouse, like Yaakov Avinu had more than one spouse. So the answer is as follows. It's not lawful for Jews to marry more than one wife. In all European countries, they conform to the general practice marrying only one. So technically speaking, it's not unlawful for Jews to have more than one wife. In reality, Jews did not have more than one wife. In certain Islamic societies, there were Jews up until the modern period who did practice polygamy. But in European countries, for hundreds of years, there had not been Jews who were practicing polygamy of any sort. And as a matter of fact, the famous Takana de Rabbeinu Gershom Or HaGola made a number of very famous takanot. He put it on the books, as it were, that you can't have more than one wife. But even when he did that around 1,000 years ago, it was no longer the practice. There were other technical reasons, which I won't go into, why he felt it necessary to put it on the books at that moment in time. But it was already not the practice. If it was happening, it was a tiny minority. The answer goes on. Moses does not command expressly to take several, but he does not forbid it. It's not a mitzvah to have more than one wife, but neither is it forbidden. And as a matter of fact, even when Jews did practice polygamy, it was a pretty rare thing. There are, of course, a number of incidences of it in the Tanakh. Most famously, probably Yaakov Avinu had more than one wife. But most of the people you meet in Tanakh, most of the people you meet in the Bible, had only one wife. Moses didn't command it, but neither did he forbid it. He seems even to adopt that custom is generally prevailing, since he settles the rights of inheritance between children of different wives. The Torah is aware of the fact that this is a condition which could exist. Although this practice still prevails in the East, yet their ancient doctors have enjoined them to restrain from taking more than one wife, except when the man is enabled by his fortune to maintain several. That's already in the idea in the Gemara that that there's a financial component to it, that you can't have more than one wife if you're not able to support everyone properly. The case has been different in the Western world. The wish of adopting the customs of the inhabitants of this part of the world has induced the Jews to renounce polygamy. But as several individuals still indulge in that practice, a synod was convened in Worms in the 11th century. This is talking about Rabbeinu Gershom, composed of 100 rabbis with Gershom at their head. The assembly pronounced an anathema against every Israelite who should in the future take more than one wife. Although this prohibition was not to last forever, the influence of European manners has universally prevailed. So what's the tenor of this answer? What's somebody try to sum up, not what the answer is, but what's the thrust of what they're trying to do, what they're trying to accomplish with this answer? Okay. Sherry says we're just like you. Right, that's technically, you've summarized it accurately, that we don't have more than one wife. You've summarized that accurately, but that's the pshat. What's the drash here? What are they trying to convey? Yeah, that we can be good French Jews, that we're not repulsive to the contemporary norms of marriage, or Sherry says we're just like you. Our laws don't conflict with what's expected of us, and we're flexible. It's true that Judaism allows it, but it's also true that we on our own have gotten rid of it because it is not in line with the prevailing customs. So the first at bat, they lay this down. We can be flexible. We can adopt. We can adapt. We can get in line with general culture. We can get in line with general culture. Now, it's easier to do it on a point like this. It's always easier to do that when you're being machmir, when you're being stringent. It's true that Torah allows you to have more than one wife. It was never the predominant custom. There was probably never an era where the majority of Jews were having more than one. I mean, just for technical reasons, you know, there's only so many women to go around. And even if the women outnumber the men, because men tend to, you know, get killed in wars and things like that, but there's still only so many women to go around. So you're never going to have a circumstance where you have 50% of the society are married to more than one woman. But it's not a mitzvah to get married to more than one woman. So if we say that you can't get married to more than one woman, you're not losing out on anything. But what would happen if we have to adopt in a way where we would have to be mekel, where we'd have to be lenient, where we'd have to permit something which is forbidden? That's a stickier question. Let's just quickly review some of the other questions, some of the answers you can read on your own. The second question, is divorce allowed by the Jewish religion? Is divorce valid when not pronounced by courts of justice by virtue of laws in contradiction with those of the French code? So obviously divorce is allowed by Judaism. But the question is going to the mechanics. In other words, to decide a question of who's married and who's divorced, meaning who's married and who's no longer married, who gets to make those determinations? These are things that the modern society, that the bureaucratic society, wants to reserve for itself. So we need to have some kind of accommodation by which we say that the state determines who's married and the state determines who's not married. Now, the truth is, in Western society, we've worked this out very well. You go to the chuppah, you get married, the rabbi conducts the ceremony, but you also have a civil marriage license. And the state will outsource the ability to function as the, what we call the Masader Kedushin, to function as the person that makes that happen. But when the rabbi does that and then signs the marriage certificate, or the priest doesn't signs the marriage certificate, they're acting as an agent of the state. The state recognizes that they can perform this act. You know, like you see on television. You know, by the power vested in me by the state of Connecticut. You know, the priest. We don't say that at Jewish weddings, but by the power vested in me, I now pronounce you man and wife. What does that mean? You know, on television, when you see that, the priest says that, by the power vested in me. He's saying that really it's the state that determines who is married. You know, this is part of the question that's caught up with this issue of same-sex union in America. Right? Can a state make determination? And it's the state that determines who are the two entities. Formerly, it was always a man and a woman, or a woman and a man. But who are the two entities that can enter into this relationship called marriage? That's something determined by the state. So that's part of what's at the root of this question. Right, then correct. In other words, the same thing with divorce. Divorce is undoing the marriage. And then there's the question of the Catholic attitude towards divorce. And of course, France is a predominantly Catholic state. They don't have an issue per se with the idea that Jews would allow divorce. But But the question is, technically, how does it work? I'm just trying to look at some of these back and forths in the questions and answers here. Can a Jewess marry a Christian and a Jew a Christian woman? It's an interesting phraseology. Or does the law allow the Jews to marry only among themselves? Right? So, you know, right there, the question of to what degree are you going to be fully part of society? And again, here, the answer is somewhat slippery. The next question, in either case, what line of conduct does their law prescribe towards Frenchmen not of their religion? So what's the status of the Frenchman in the eyes of Jewish law? Here the answer is quite telling. The line of conduct prescribed towards Frenchmen not of our religion, you know, what used to be called Goyim, is the same as that prescribed between Jews themselves. We admit of no differences but that of worshipping the Supreme Being, every one in his own way. This is a very, very diplomatic answer, and it skirts some very significant topics. The answer to the preceding question has explained the line of conduct which the law of Moses and the Talmud prescribe towards Frenchmen, not of our religion. At the present time, when the Jews no longer form a separate nation, but enjoy the advantage of being incorporated with the great nation, which privilege they consider... Let me just turn the page. Which privilege they consider as a kind of political redemption, right? The language is so charged, right? To be a Frenchman is a form of geula. It's a form of redemption, although political redemption, not spiritual redemption. It is impossible that a Jew should treat a Frenchman not of his religion in any other manner than he would treat one of his Israelite brethren. But of course, everybody's aware of this question of... of money lending, for example. Jews lend money at interest to non-Jews, but the Torah forbids that for Jews to lend money to other Jews. Let's just skip ahead. Seventh question, who names the rabbis? Again, this question of authority and autonomy. What police jurisdiction do rabbis exercise among the Jews? What judicial power do they enjoy among them? You know, most contemporary rabbis would find this question very humorous, the idea that the rabbis exercise a police jurisdiction, that they have that kind of power. You know, it's, you know, there was, you know, a number of years ago, the question of rabbinic authority was, you know, was very hotly debated. I recall some essay that a rabbi wrote, the title of which was something like, I could use a little rabbinic authority. are there professions which the laws of the Jews forbid them from exercising? Right? Now, that's part of the Enlightenment is this idea that we're going to integrate the Jews into society, and not only are they going to be good Frenchmen and good citizens, they're going to be productive. They're going to occupy trades, and they're going to have professions which are going to both enable them to live without, you know, creating a welfare state, and they are going to contribute to the greater commonweal, like those good assimilated Sephardic Jews down in the Southwest, who they're greasing the wheels of transatlantic trade. It's good for everyone. So are there any professions that they can't do? So they answered, there are none. On the contrary, the Talmud expressly declares that a father who does not teach a profession his child rears him up to be a villain. Now, this is pretty accurate, but the question is more important than the answer. But you have to understand the question behind the question. Does the law forbid the Jew from taking usury from their brethren? And there it is, right there on the black on white, but what about money lending? And here, it's a diplomatic answer that's so diplomatic that it warps the reality. Deuteronomy says, thou shalt not lend upon interest to thy brother. Interest of money, interest of victuals, interest of anything that is lent upon interest. Right? You can't take ribit, you can't take neshech, the Torah calls interest. He can't do it to your brother. The Hebrew word neshech has been improperly translated by the word usury. In the Hebrew language, it means interest of any kind and not usury interest. It cannot then be taken in the meaning now given the word usury. So the first answer it points out is that the contemporary form of banking and ribit and interest is different than what the Torah was talking about. But now, 12th question, does it forbid or does it allow to take usury from strangers? Now, when the Torah talks about brothers and strangers, it's talking about Jews and non-Jews. We have seen in the answer to the foregoing question that the prohibition of usury, the answer, considered as the smallest interest, was a maximum of charity and of benevolence toward the commercial regulation. And it was condemned by the Torah and by the Talmud. We are generally forbidden, always on the score of charity, to lend upon interest to our fellow citizens of different persuasions, as well as to our fellow Jews. Now, this is really quite, this is really pushing it. Our fellow citizens become our brothers. And again, it's a statement of the degree to which we're willing to be accommodating and flexible and to go along, to get along, not initially, but then at a certain point they were. At a certain point they were. Right. No, and that's part of the point. That in other words, if we open up other trades and other professions and guilds and etc. to the Jew, so then he's going to have other options, and he's going to be able to reform himself. The French understood it's a two-way street. The French understood that it's a two-way street. So as the polygon advances, emancipation advances, and at the same time, there's an interest in reforming things back home. Now again, Napoleon is motivated by a desire to be consistent with the ideals of the revolution, but he's also aware that we're sitting here in France, but, you know, up here in Poland, you've heard of Poland, there are a lot of Jews over there. And if we can do things if we can do things if we can do right by the Jews might be helpful to us, because we are interested not only in reforming and being good to the Jews, but we are interested in moving from here to here. And for some reason, like others before him and others after him, what's that old pithy expression? Never wage a land war in Asia. The idea that we could invade Russia, in the winter no less, and do that was with the idea that, well, you know, Jews are all over the place and we're going to need their help, etc. We'll continue with this topic and how it played itself out in French and European culture when we continue next week. If you're interested, though, you might want to look over the whole document of the response of the Jewish notables, which you can download from the website. I'll stay on for a couple of minutes if anyone has any questions. And during the week, of course, you're always welcome to email me or chat me by Google or Skype to that name or to the email if you want to be in touch as we move along.